Good afternoon, Clear Creek County, and this is the What's Upstream Show. I'm here with my co-host, Lori Beckel, and our esteemed guest, Christine Bradley. We're going to talk about some Clear Creek County history, some exciting stuff today. I'm sure that you'll enjoy it. And before we get started, first thing I want to say, I want to shout out to Lou Howard and her family. They've had a little medical setback in the family, and maybe not so little, but a medical setback. And our thoughts and prayers go out to Lou and her family. So
indeed, absolutely, we miss you.
Yeah. And hopefully,
I'm going to talk too much.
Hopefully, she'll be back next month. And I also want to say, while I've got the floor here, that Lori, thank you so much for carrying the ball while I've been out of town. You did an excellent job. It was I'm a little bit jealous at how great you do, but I'll try to pick up my game here.
Glad to have you back, Mark.
Thank you. If you want to answer that, Lori, that's fine. So we're here, as I said, with Christine Bradley, and Chris is she's going to talk about labor unions and labor strife that went on in Clear Creek County, in the mining camps in the 1890s, in particular, I guess. And I want to say right up front, Chris, you sent me that article that you wrote in 2004, was it?
Yeah, 2003, actually.
2003, and it's incredible. You are an amazing talent.
Well, I like doing the articles. You know, I've written two books, and actually I brought the second book in just in case. But I really prefer taking a topic like this one, like labor unions, and just doing that in a 10 to 15 page and having it be over with. So, yeah, this was fun and nice to be able to find some good sources that gave us interesting information. And who knew, you know?
Yeah, there's a lot of information there. You have many, many sources.
Enough to put you to sleep.
Oh, no, not me. I think it's a great topic. I think it's a terrific reminder of the constant struggle for people to make a dignified wage and provide for their families.
And you and I both grew up in Rochester, and both Kodak and Xerox were non-union plants.
Yes, they were.
I'm not sure, but I know Kodak.
So
I sort of grew up in that sense. And then as I've gotten older and worked in other places, and you start to realize the things that did come out from unions, like an eight-hour day, or a requirement that you pay someone for hours worked, or overtime. And those are things which weren't there at all at this point in time that we're going to be talking about.
Chris, you mentioned Rochester, and now I'm going to have to elaborate a little bit on for folks who don't know. But Kodak, Rochester was a Kodak town for a long time. And Kodak wasn't really close to a monopoly in the photography business for 100 years. And so they had the luxury of treating their employees as family, and they did. My grandfather, when he retired from Kodak, they gave him a medallion. that I have. It was a 5-inch medallion. And they told them, "You've been a great employee. Anybody in your family needs a job. Tell them to bring No questions asked. They got a job."
Well, my dad worked there. And I remember in the spring every year, they would give out bonuses to the employees. Mm-hmm. And they were good bonuses.
Substantial, right?
My dad would always let me pick whether I wanted $50 or the last four numbers on the check. And I got it right every year.
But
it was a good company, and they had good benefits, but they did it, and knowingly so, because they didn't want unions to come in. But it worked. It worked for the company, worked for the city, and we won't talk about some of their decisions that they made then later, like, "Oh, here, we'll just give this technology to Microsoft."
Yeah,
anyway,
that's right. Yeah. But the reason I wanted to go into that a little bit is that, in my mind, Kodak represents the extreme end of an employer who was secure in what they were doing, and was able to transfer that security to their employees. And the mining industry is at the other end of that extreme.
Yeah.
And that's why unions were so necessary for the miners.
Yep. Absolutely. Well, shall I get into
yes,
the background?
Please. Let's go. Oh.
So it may be necessary again, I might just say.
Yeah. History
is a
prelude.
Way of repeating itself. So, but I wrote an article called Which Side Are You On, Boys? Which Side Are You On? Labor Unions in Early Clear Creek County, Colorado. And it was published by Historic Georgetown. And I'm going to get it out on the library digital website as soon as I get back to my office. I haven't been there for a while. Anyway, but I will put it out there for people who want more in-depth information. But there was a Hard Rock Miners Union formed in Central City in 1863, followed by the Miners Protective Association in Nevada that same year. And they didn't really seem to have any impact on Clear Creek County. Things were pretty much just getting going. And if you think about, you know, George Jackson and those guys who are coming out and they're just going to a creek and you're swirling your pan and you find gold, mm-hmm. well, that's about as straightforward as it gets. Mm-hmm. So you have your money and there you are. But once they start needing to do more underground mining and other things, then the whole operation becomes more complicated.
That takes capital.
It takes capital.
And if you're out prospecting, you don't have, you know, whatever money is necessary.
They tended to, and sometimes went into, you know, smaller groups. But yeah, it really worked best if they could get corporations from the East Coast or overseas to mm-hmm. be bringing in money. And that's,
And why was that, Chris?
Well, because you wouldn't have enough money here in the state for people to really be doing this. And so you're going big bucks by the time you're drilling a tunnel or putting up a plant. And
that capital just didn't exist in the U.S.
It did, but in the U.S. it was probably going to be in Philadelphia or New York or places
and
like
that. And invested elsewhere.
And Lori, another feature there, or factor I should say, is that there was mining, extensive mining throughout the United States.
Yeah.
So there, you have a limited number of investors who are able to understand and willing to put their money into that kind of an enterprise. And so because of that limit, you might have to extend your reach to overseas.
And they were putting in big amounts. Now, investors from other places is something that follows all the way through into the early 20th century. I tell you, I found out to my surprise that my great-grandparents came out and invested in the Jewel Mining Company in Silver Plume. And who knew? There's a little note saying that, you know, my grandfather's coming out to visit his family. And I'm like, in Silver Plume? 1907.
Wow.
But let me tell you, they came out, they poured money into the mountain, and they left. And they never talked about it ever again. Mm. But one of the things that happens with that is the local newspapers become promoters. And that's something that we find with researching labor unions, is some of the papers will talk about it and others won't. And my favorite dichotomy, you have A.B. Clark up in Silver Plume, who's the editor of the Silver Plume Silver Standard. And he's all union. And he talks about the fact that minerals should belong to the people, not to the individual companies.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other side, you have Jesse Randall in Georgetown, who is not going to say much about, you know, that unrest.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you, Silver Plume, Silver Standard, for being able to give us the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey would have said. But
I digress. Go,
Paul Harvey, I know. So, okay, so we've got a very early one. And then we switch on with the number of immigrants that are coming to this area early on to do mining. We find that the Irish are very interested in unions and nationalizing, and the Cornish not so much. Cornish would just as soon be off on their own. But Georgetown had a chapter of the Fenian Brotherhood in the late 1860s, early 17, and Silver Plume housed a group known as the Irish National Land League. Just guessing there a little more. And the organization excludes none, this is from the paper, excludes none on account of race, creed, or sex. Its object is to assist financially as well as morally the Irish people in its present gallant struggle against the combined tyranny of landlords and government, in the former evinced by the iniquitous system of land renting, and in the latter by the imposition of coercion acts that would be more applicable to Russian nihilists than to people peacefully but determinedly agitating for redress of the system.
Oh, my gosh.
Made Ireland the periodical beggar of the nation. So these guys are a little, you know, they're kind of into it at this point.
Well, let's pause there for a second and think about it. Why would the Irish be
more prone
to a union because they had lived under the thumb of colonialism for and it resulted in the starvation of I don't know what the percentage, but a huge number of people in Ireland, and so they carry that legacy
they
with them.
They carry it forward, and we'll find in later years that it's the Irish and the Italians, Mark.
They had the same sort of thing, yeah.
But the Cornish tended to like going off on their own. But there are organizations. There are Knights of Labor in Georgetown. In December 1885, the Georgetown chapter placed an ad for the first annual ball of Assembly Number 1, Knights of Labor of Georgetown. And then there's also Knights of Labor in Silver Plume. And they had, they were there about the same time as the group in Georgetown, and they joined with the Ancient Order of Hibernians, you might guess they're Irish, and Bishop Joseph Matchbuff to purchase what's now known as the Catholic section of the Silver Plume Cemetery. So they are up there. But then all of a sudden things start getting more radical in other parts of the country, and the Knights of Labor start pulling back pretty, and the Fenians pull back pretty quickly. So after the Haymarket Square riot in Chicago in 1886,
Chris, can you talk about that for a moment?
Not in any depth. I just
it was a bloody mess.
Bloody mess. Yeah.
Right. Okay.
But I could give you my I think this, but let's not go there because I may if somebody knows more than I do, going to be
okay.
They'll be laughing
Fair
at me.
Enough.
But yeah, but in any event, it was huge, and it was Chicago. May 4th, 1886. So then the Silver Plume Knights of Labor say the attention of this assembly having been called by citizens of Georgetown to expressions alleged to have been made by professed members of this order, to wit, endorsements of the anarchist idea. Oh my, there are probably some frogs out there someplace.
Anarchist,
and approvals
yes.
of the ultra-socialistic doctrine and expressions of sympathy with the rioters and the late Chicago trouble, we'll just call it that. Said proposed members being also charged with having expressed the hope that the latter city would be laid in ashes, we as members of the noble order of the Knights of Labor disclaim any sympathy with such sentiments. So that's one where people were moving one direction, then all of a sudden you get a very violent mob-related situation.
And you don't want to be associated with
it. And you don't want to be associated with that. So what's starting to happen in the late 1880s, mining is starting to struggle somewhat. And people don't realize – well, let's go back. Georgetown, Silver Plume, Empire, Idaho Springs. So Idaho Springs and Empire are mostly gold mining towns. Georgetown, Silver Plume, mostly silver mining towns. There's some gold around silver mines, and there's some silver around gold mines.
Right.
But for the most part, those two communities are going that way. And the fates of silver and the price of silver is becoming more tied in with government purchasing. So it isn't just, and also the fact that they're mining at other places. So they're mining huge amounts in India. And so the price is starting to go down. And those investors we talked about are starting to look at places other than Colorado. Or if they're in Colorado, they're looking at Leadville or the San Juans. They're not looking at our neighborhood up here. And gold mining's just sort of the constant putt, 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 and it keeps going along. So, anyway, all right, I digress. So where are we? We are, let's see. So then we've got some strikes that start happening in the 1890s. The first actual mention of a local labor union comes in 1892, and the Courier says a meeting was held at the courthouse on this is Clear Creek Courthouse, on Tuesday evening for the purpose of organizing a miners' union. By the middle of 1893, comments began to be made about hiring of cheap or replacement labor and the pending reduction in wages. So from the Silver Standard, the Silver Plume paper, the citizens and miners of Cripple Creek do not believe in having cheap labor imported into the place to work on the waterworks which are being put up by Michigan Pipe Company. And a carload of Italians shipped in for that purpose were forced to leave. Of course, all those who live there and desire work should be given it in preference to outsiders. But if the company contracted to have the work completed by a certain time could not get enough men in that vicinity to do it, there should be no objection. Well, there was objection, obviously. So the article brought up, that article brings up a touchy subject for many locals. There's a difference between immigrants who lived and worked in the community and those who were imported to work at a lower rate of pay. Nevertheless, there we'd find in later years Silver Plume miners leaving their families to go work in Butte or Cripple Creek or other places when the silver mines had trouble. So strikes in Cripple Creek and Leadville in the 1890s focused more attention on those labor unions, and the issues began to crystallize. The sides became further apart. Leadville miners go on strike in 1893 and again more violently in 1896. And the Pullman strikes in Chicago were 1894. So many local miners were getting desperate for work, but strike breaking wasn't considered because if your business was struggling, striking would simply kill the business. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't that we're going to strike and you need to pay us and get us back. It was we're going to strike and they'd say, okay, it's been nice knowing you. So that becomes a bit of a dilemma. Do you want to take a break now?
Sure. I'm at your service, Chris. Okay. Chris needs a little break to catch up. Okay.
Yep, I do.
Fair enough. And in the meantime, I'm excited to play some music. For those of you who maybe have missed this, this past weekend was the Chopin competition in Warsaw. And this is a competition that occurs every 5 years. An American won it this year, American of Chinese descent won it, and we're going to hear him play right now. Okay, everyone. We're back with Christine Bradley, our preeminent historian here in Clear Creek County, and she has deeply investigated the history of mining activity here in the community. And thanks again for joining us,
sure,
Chris.
Sure. Sure. Well, and the thing about labor and unions. I'm going to apologize for the fact that I don't have a lot of information from the Idaho Springs newspapers. When I did this in 2003, it was before there were digitized papers. Mm. So I read all the Georgetown papers up to about 1920. I don't have much of a life. And all the Silver Plume newspapers.
In black and white. I mean, you were reading the paper.
Yeah, I was reading. Well, I was reading microfilm just to make my eyes go crazy. I did that for the county for a number of topics because people would ask questions and I'd be going, I read something about that. Well, did I read it in an 1880 paper or anyway? So I read through the papers and made notes, and those notes are part of what makes doing this program possible because I've got cheat sheets. But in this case, I apologize to folks in Idaho Springs for not having as much of their information, but we'll get there. Also wanted to mention that when I took Colorado history from Liston Leyendecker up at CSU, and he told the class specifically, do not go down to Ludlow or Victor and start asking questions about mines and mining strikes. Mm-hmm. It's still too raw. And that was in the mid-70s, so maybe by this time now it would be, you know, a little calmer. But you're looking at people who still bear grudges, and it's still, you know, it's one thing if it's just someone in the past that was shot at or killed. It's another thing if it's a member of the family. I went up to Butte, Montana a number of years ago, and I remember going into a coffee shop and just looking for a cup of coffee. There was Cindy Neely. And we just went in and were sort of looking around like, okay, you know, hi, we're not anti-union, we're not pro-union, we're just, you know, tourists. But it was just the whole aura, the feeling that was there in the town, that which side of the street you were on kind of made a difference. But, okay, back to Clear Creek and Clear Creek mining unions and the like. There are two different ways that people tend to work for mines. We were talking about this earlier, Mark. You could be day labor, where you would work for one of the larger companies for $3.50 a day. Or you could work on a leasing system. So you would go up to Mr. Hamill, who owned or managed all the mines of the terrible mining company, and you could want to go up and work this specific drift. And then whatever you got out, you know, you were paid for. And there was a difference. Back to the Irish and the Italians tended to like to work for day labor. And the Cornish and many others tended to prefer leasing. And leasing works if you're finding ore and you can figure out how to get it to the processor, get it down to the smelter. Some of the lease arrangements meant that you had to bring your product down to the mine owner, who then had the option of holding it until the price went up, if he was going to get 10% or whatever percent of that. And that then ended up making people a little more, a little less happy. But there was...
Because they didn't get paid.
They didn't get paid. Until things got better. And if things didn't get better, they're still there and they've already done the work. So
when we were talking about this before the show started, I compared that working on a contract to sharecropping in the South. Mm-hmm. And you know, from my point of view, I'll take the side of the Irish and the Italian miners at the time and say that just pay me for my work because you're the one who put up your capital. You wanted to make a bet on this. Mm-hmm. I wasn't involved in that. You want to buy my labor?
Yeah, pay me.
Sure.
Yeah. So there's.
Seems like a no-brainer to me.
Well, except
maybe I'm not Cornish.
But some people just really didn't want to have to work for, you know, this guy over here. They'd rather do it themselves. And as with most labor or other economic issues, when times are good, it all works out. And when times are bad, nothing works out. And then who's impacted more. I'll watch my language.
Chris, tell me if you think this is a factor. The Cornish came from the mines in Cornwall.
And the Irish
and the Italians did not.
In northern Italy, there were mines up there.
Primarily, the miners were more highly skilled if you looked at the broad section of them.
Well, and the other thing we don't know, I don't know that anybody's ever pulled together how many mines actually hired day labor and how many of them didn't. So the larger ones certainly did, but I don't know. Yeah, so that's for a historian of a different time. But I've got one quote here from... that references William Hamel, and I did. William Hamel was my master's thesis, and he was a bit of a stuffed shirt. I don't know that that's the right phrasing, but well, when he worked in Denver at one point, he complained that the elevator operator wasn't in livery. Okay, so that gives you an idea of where he stands. However,
what does that mean?
He wasn't livery. Wearing an appropriate uniform.
I see.
Like you would find at one of the New York fancy hotels where the bellhop has a uniform or whatever. So he wasn't in livery. But in 1894, it says the state's leading mining men considered a proposal to close all of the state's mines in an effort to break the back of the state's unions. Pretty extensive. Denver papers quoted local mine owner William Hamel, whose response sounded more reasonable than many. And a lot of times, Hamel doesn't sound reasonable. So this one. It was reported in a Denver paper this week that a movement was on foot among some of the leading mine owners to hold a meeting in Denver, blah, 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 blah. General Hamel was interviewed on the subject and was reported as saying, "It cannot be done. I know that Clear Creek County will go right along, even though every mine in Cripple Creek and Leadville should be shut down forever and filled with water to the brim." Because that's what, if you close a mine, Hamel goes on, "The solution of this whole difficulty is to work the mines on a lease system. A miner then earns exactly what he makes, and whether he makes 50 cents a day or $20 a day, he never thinks of striking. The leasing plan is followed in all mining camps, and even in Cripple Creek, there are scores of properties worked under lease. A man working under lease may belong to the union or he may not. Unions thrive just as well under one plan as under the other." So he's actually sounding...
There's one man's opinion.
Yeah. So the papers continue to note the increasing number of layoffs, wage reductions, and failure to pay, which is really a problem at this point in time in the 90s. No state laws at this time required payment for hours worked. I mean, that's something we just take under, of course, if you work, you have to get paid. Well, yeah, not necessarily.
Well, not necessarily right now.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Look at the government layoff, yeah. So a change was made in the management of the PAROC this week. A gentleman from England by the name of Ercochi taking charge of the mine. Some of the stockholders are expected over the next month when it is probable that arrangements will be made to settle all local indebtedness, which will be appreciated by those whose pay is several months behind. These guys aren't making much to begin with, and several months behind becomes a problem. So at this point in time, then, you're starting to find more union activity on a statewide and national level, and we're about to see Silver Plume, December 1894, the Federation of Labor Delegates visit Silver Plume. Tuesday was an exciting day for Silver Plume, and for a time it resembled a tourist day in the summer, as the delegates of the American Federation of Labor came over the loop on a special train and remained several hours. They were accompanied by a number of prominent citizens of Denver, including Mayor Van Horn. The distinguished visitors were met at the depot by Mayor Cowell and City Council, Representative Gallagher, and a number of other citizens, and escorted to the Opera House, where they were cordially welcomed in a brief address. President Gompers, President Gompers replied to the mayor's welcome, and John Burns, Mayor Van Horn, and others made brief addresses. The visitors were escorted to the Diamond Tunnel and had an opportunity of witnessing mining operations and forming some idea of the actual cost of producing silver. A round of holes were blasted, and after the smoke had cleared away, Mr. Burns took a pick, provided himself and others with specimens of ore. John Burns takes great interest in children and educational members and intended to visit our schools while he was here, but found he did not have sufficient time. He charged Mr. Gallagher, however, to give his love to the children of Silver Plume and their teachers, and Mr. Gallagher desires to deliver the message through the columns of the Standard. Mr. Burns also paid the place a high compliment, and this is one of my favorite lines.
I love this.
Yeah. He also paid the place a high compliment of saying it was built on the right plan. That is, the best building is a schoolhouse and the poorest is a jail.
Isn't that great?
I love that. So
you know, if you took that as a philosophy of community planning.
Yes. Yep.
Oh, my gosh.
So by the time the American Federation of Labor delegates arrived in Silver Plume, they may have spoken in Georgetown as well. I'm not sure because, of course, Georgetown was the Georgetown Courier, and Randall's not going to tell us.
Yeah, he doesn't care.
The early unions formed in 1892 had already collapsed because after the withdrawal of the Sherman Silver Purchase Act in 1893, they're sort of hanging on by their fingernails.
Chris, just a moment. I think you're on to something there because if Samuel Gomper and the mayor of Denver were at this event, they must have stopped in Georgetown.
So. Maybe I need to go back and look further, but that's where you really do get into boosterism, and especially if times are tough, they're not going to say, here's the Western Federation of Miners, aren't we pleased? No, they weren't.
Yeah.
So I need to go back. Now that, thank you, Clear Creek Library District, for digitizing so many of our newspapers. I can go back and double check, but in any event, it definitely stands out in the Silver Standard, our source of good knowledge. So things are definitely becoming tough. And the meeting, let's see, they have interest regenerated in the mid-1896, possibly because of the national election. So there's a real, you know, everybody, well, not everybody, a lot of people on the western end of the county really wanted William Jennings Bryan. Mm-hmm. And they thought he, with him would come, you know, the saving grace for the mining industry and everything else. So they are all together and doing that. I would say that my friend Mr. Hamill did not support Bryan. He was he was a McKinley man. Yeah. So he had all these silver mines, and he supported someone who believed in the gold standard. What can I say?
Chris, I'm going to step out on a limb here, if you don't mind, for a moment, and just try to give a broader context here. In the 1890s, this was a period of the accumulation of great wealth by capitalists in this country, and most people who labored, not on farms, but in industries anywhere in our country, they worked for slave wages, really, and lived
and
in squalid.
Farmers were getting nothing.
Yeah, and farmers, forget about it. You were on your own. But people lived in squalid conditions, and there was great turmoil around the accumulation of wealth from a few, and most people not having money, and William Jennings Bryan, to get back to what you were saying, he was the champion of labor rights.
Yep. Okay. And so much, and they really, so there was, they had, they all got together in Silver Plume at the Knights of Pythias Hall to wait for the results. And we get them on TV, they're getting them by telegraph and everything. And they're very, very disappointed, of course. And that sort of becomes, it's a major ratchet down for the mining industry, especially around Silver Plume. Georgetown had already started to quiet down at that point in time, but Plume kept believing. They just figured it. Well, Silver Plume, where the school is built in 1894, so the year after the repeal of the Sherman Silver Purchase Act, and other things where they believe in their community. So things are going. There is a increase in. All right, where did I leave off here? We've got the. All right. So, the card. this is what I was looking for, the Rathbone Sisters, who are part, they're the Women's Associate of the Knights of Pythias, wish to tender a vote of thanks to the public for their liberal patronage on November 3rd, the night of our leader's, Brian's, sad defeat. Every soul within these walls was anxiously waiting for the returns. It was needless to ask which of the candidates was ahead. One look over that crowd was enough to tell the story. The cast of faces will never be forgotten. Oh, we've all been a different we've all had both
the
sides.
Agony of defeat.
Both sides, we've all watched one of those. Dear people, be brave. Every heart has its grief sooner or later. And all these aimless conflicts of our minds and unanswered longings of our hearts should lead us to rejoice the more in the divine assurance that our time is coming. I don't know that. Anyway, just four more years of blighted hopes when we will greet you again with Brian as our leader, when night shall melt into noon and the mystery shall be clothed with glory. And we hope once more to give you a Baltimore fry. I don't know what a Baltimore fry is. Give you a Baltimore fry and stop our stewing. Anyway.
Yeah. So
that's so.
Yeah.
That,
so now the unions have risen, and now they've had a dramatic defeat.
Yes.
And
so they're
pick up the pieces
pick
and
up
move
the pieces.
On. But Chris, you want to take a quick break?
A quick one would be great.
Okay. Thank you, Eric Liu and Chris. You've collected your thoughts, and we're ready to go.
I collected my thoughts. Liu, if you didn't know how much you missed, this is part of it because we normally just go back and forth, and then when Lou's doing that, I'm over here shuffling my little papers, and when I'm doing mine, she's shuffling hers. Okay, so we left off with the defeat of William Jennings Bryan and trying to figure out what a Baltimore fry is. That will wait for another time. So what we've got happening is... In 1901, so at this point in time, you're several years beyond the real drop in the silver market, but it's still, they're still producing silver, they're producing ore. So the Silver Plume Papers has an announcement of a strike of another kind. Silver Plume has experienced a great many strikes, but they were usually of a kind that, if not hailed with joy, at least caused no regret on the part of anyone. They were strikes of mineral, either in some new location or in the mines that were already producing, but in any event, they added to the welfare of the camp. A strike of a different nature occurred last Saturday, however, when the men employed on the Mendota property, or most of them at least, decided they would not do any more work for the company until they were paid for what they had already done. But as we were talking about, yes, we're going to strike, and bad news is so. On Tuesday, the men who had been working at the Mendota were paid the amount due them for work in December, but operations of the mine were not resumed, does not appear to be known when work will be commenced again. So good news, bad news, you got paid, but you no longer have a job. So now we're going to come down to the eastern end of the county and what starts happening here. So we've skipped from the silver end of the county to the gold end of the county. And so gold is still being produced down here in Idaho Springs. And we've got our we have our newspaper dilemma where the two papers are going to be talking completely different. There is one problem. In 1895, the rhetoric heats up with the introduction of Chinese workers to a mine on Ute Creek. Mm-hmm. Idaho Springs miners do not approve of the introduction of cheap Chinese labor and drive them from camp. Long article. So it was the mine owned by the Argonaut Mining Company of Denver. So you can tell things are getting tight. But what ends up happening in August... What year am I here? In August, I think we're about 1902. 42, yeah, 1903. Things were quieting down. They thought there was a miners' union at Idaho Springs, made a demand for an eight-hour day. It's the first time we see that. In all the mines in the district beginning May 1st, the demand also includes that the men will go to work for their own time but come out on the company's time. Not quite sure
what that means.
I don't know what that means. And it is not likely that the mine managers will agree to this proposition. It looks as if there's more trouble ahead.
I can tell you what that means.
It means if you want to go to work at 8, you go to work at 8.
Yeah. You go down and if your shift starts at 8, as you said, you'd start whatever amount of time you needed to get down to your work site by 8 o'clock.
Okay.
So if it took you half an hour, you'd have to take a half an hour of your time.
Okay.
To commute to your work site.
Yeah. Okay.
And what about the other end?
You would if it took a half an hour to come out. You'd come out a half an hour before the end of your shift because that would be on the company time.
I see.
So
that sounds way too fair.
Yeah, I know.
Reasonable.
However,
it's pretty reasonable.
So by June, things are starting to quiet down. Miners Union at Idaho Springs has issued notices requesting all miners and others to keep away from this district as the union claims the strike is still on. However, yeah, it's still there. But in August, things really blew up, and I put that in quotation. So there's dynamite used to destroy Sun and Moon buildings. And the Sun and Moon mine is up at the top of Gilson Gulch. And I know it's right up at the top because in my archives, there's a map that was drawn of the site of the dynamite blast because they were trying to figure out where an individual died, and would it be the jurisdiction of Clear Creek or Gilpin? Mm. So they drew it out, and there's a picture of the building and the body and the keg of dynamite. It's really cool,
Do you know where Gilson Gulch is? Mm-hmm. I'm not familiar with that.
It's at
the east end of town.
East end of town. You go up, if you start at Starbucks, and go up the gulch that's a little further east from there.
Okay.
It's generally accessed from going up Virginia Canyon Road and over towards the Gem and all of those other big mines that way.
Wow.
So
yeah, it's steep and narrow. You could never really go up it from down where it starts.
Okay.
Ends, I guess.
Yeah, it would be. It's a pretty. There was a road. There's a bridge and a road that went straight up there at one time. But okay. So dynamite used to destroy Sun and Moon buildings. Union leaders driven out of Idaho Springs by citizens. The labor difficulties existing at Idaho Springs for some time reached an acute stage, you could call it that, an acute stage this week as announced elsewhere, culminating in the destruction of the transformer house of the Sun and Moon mine by dynamite on Tuesday night at 11:20 p.m. The Sun and Moon property, the head of Gilson Gulch, had been operated to a limited extent since the 1st of June with non-union men, so that's where it's getting tight. And it's believed that it was the intention of the dynaminers to destroy the compressor plant and shaft house also, but the plan miscarried owing to the discovery of the perpetrators of the deed before they had time to fully carry out their design. As the property was carefully guarded, the plan adopted was to place the dynamite in beer kegs, attach a fuse, and roll them down the hill against the buildings. And it was when a match was struck to light the fuse that the men were discovered and fired upon by the guard. But the keg was sent down the hill and landed against the transformer house where it exploded, wrecking the building, which then took fire, but the flames were prevented from reaching the other buildings. A search of the surroundings resulted in finding Philip Fire, an Austrian miner and a member of the union, a short distance from the scene, who had been so badly wounded that he died a short time after being found. It does not seem to be known what caused his death. At first, it was supposed that he had been shot by the watchmen or accidentally by one of his companions as they fired several shots at the men who were guarding the mine, but an autopsy revealed the wound was not inflicted by a bullet, but apparently caused by an explosive. As soon as the news of the affair reached Idaho Springs, there's intense excitement, and the authorities commenced arresting prominent union men and placing them in jail until a score or more had been locked up. Frank Napoli and John Carbonetti. Yeah, I'm just looking.
Goombas.
Goombas were arrested on Wednesday and are believed to be the men who were with fire and associated in the work of blowing up the mine buildings, as they were seen in company with him late in the evening on the streets of the city. On Wednesday evening, the Citizens Protective League held an indignation meeting. Held an indignation meeting and then proceeded to the jail where the union men were confined and escorted 14 of them to the city limits, ordered them to leave and never return. H.E. Gregory, a member of the Georgetown Union, was arrested on Thursday evening on the charge of having made threats to blow up the pipeline or dam of United Light and Power Company above Denver. The affair is an unfortunate one from all points of view, but if it results in a restoration of peace in the camp, why would it result in peace in the camp? Anyway, so that the operations may be carried on in all the mines with a full force of men, without further incident, something will have been gained at least. So then Randall, my friend Jesse Randall, he's not really my friend, Jesse Randall of the Georgetown Courier quickly sides with the members of the Idaho Springs Alliance who drive the labor leaders out of town. The Idaho Springs affair continues to be subject of general discussion on the outside and investigations on the inside. While various labor unions have condemned the act of the Alliance in driving men out of the town, the Denver Alliance upholds the act, and there you have it. The Idaho Springs Alliance and District Attorney are hunting for evidence, blah, blah, blah. So these guys pretty much just, you know, get everybody out of town, and then everybody comes back into town with attorneys. What else do? The court case dragged on for months. The miners requested the arrest of the Idaho Springs Alliance members who illegally ran the union bosses out of the town. The Alliance members pursued labor leaders, the Alliance being the sort of the Chamber of Commerce folks, pursued the labor leaders whom they accused of orchestrating the violence. Politics were rife, evidence was limited, and no convictions were returned. And I then say here, the story of the Sun and Moon deserves a presentation of its own at a later date, because we really do need to know a little more about it. But it does make me wonder. I would think we're far enough away from it at this point in time that we wouldn't have the grandchildren of, well, and Mr. Fire is the one who dies, and I don't think that his relatives stay around. But I would guess there are still strong feelings on both sides within the Clear Creek Metal Miners Association. And others, you know, is it, and you're back to the same thing. Are you better off working for a company, or are you better off working on lease? So
does that association still exist?
The Clear Creek Metal Mining Association does, I believe.
It does.
Do you still hear? I mean, I assume they still do the sow belly dinner, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, I haven't heard in years, and I've never been associated with that group
myself. I went
myself.
A couple of times, and sow belly is something that I really don't need to have any more of in my life. But, you know, I think of Al Mosh and Fabian Watrous as ones who would be there through all the time. Yeah. And so I don't know if there still is some of that.
Well, Al's sons are still in the county and active in the mining industry. So I'm sure there's still interest. But
I think, and they're, what is it? I'm an independent miner. Wasn't it the IMA, the Independent Miners Association? Mm-hmm. So I see them more as the lease your mine, not the work for somebody else, but I'm not sure. I'm just sort of making that up.
Well, I just find this whole event interesting in the context of the broader labor and capital strife that went on across the country.
Yeah.
You know, it almost became inevitable because, and maybe this is a lesson for us today, that if you stand in a position inflexibly, this is the inevitable result.
The inevitable result, and at least at this point in time, with the laws that are out there, the assumption would be that people would get paid. But certainly, the fights that go on after that, and I'm I'm going to have to. I'm not. So the strikes, the big explosion in Victor, I think that's about the same time, maybe a little bit earlier. And then you have Ludlow.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And, you know, that's just.
That's the big one in our state.
That's the big one in our state.
That was the one outside of Trinidad?
Yeah, that's Ludlow. Yep.
Coal mining.
Coal mining. Mm-hmm. And my friend Verona up in Silver Plume told me that her husband's family, I think probably her husband's grandparents, were down there. They were shooting at the government forces as opposed to back. So, you know, that's why you find yourself saying, wow, even though if it's in 1918, 1920, it's still remembered by people. And
yeah, that's current enough that
current
there's
enough
still people.
And you look at it, and the whole issue between can you bring in enough people who are non-union to break the strike, mm-hmm. and the all of the amazing amount of the anger on both sides, which, mm-hmm. you know, you can understand as you look at pieces of this. But somehow, as we were doing our second history book, and I brought the first book a couple times ago, and my dear friend, Dwayne Smith, and I wrote, I bring show and tell to a radio show, so this is where it's silly, but we wrote our second book on Georgetown histories called The Once and Future Silver Queen of the Rockies. And it was a difficult book to write because you're writing about a county on the decline, and it gets really, it's a lot easier to write about times that are getting exciting and everybody's finding new things. And in this one where there's just the town or the county populations are dropping and the economic everything is on a downfall until automobiles start becoming more popular and tourism starts picking up, and then after World War II, skiing. But, you know, we needed to put some of this into here. We liked the idea of writing local history, but also felt like we needed to tie it into some of the national, but I need more. It's like, you know, we're talking about the Haymarket Square. Yeah, I know it happened, but also in the 90s, the farmers were starving, and people working in industry were, you know, just dying in these huge, some of it fires in these places and everything else.
Yeah, so there were no standards of safety.
There were no safety,
So, Chris, excuse me, but when you talked about the push for the eight-hour day, the first thing that I thought of is was the child labor that occurred in the mines in Pennsylvania, the coal mines in Pennsylvania. They would take young boys, mm-hmm. 6, 7, 9, 10 years old, and they would go down for a 12-hour shift 6 days a week, and they'd give them a potato. That was your meal for the day, and they were down there to pick the rock out of the coal, and that's what they did. Children, while Rockefeller and Morgan and all the rest of them were becoming multi-billionaires.
Because they could just scrape the profit off and pay not much, because even if you were only paid, and the level of pay had dropped from, I want to say, $3.50 an hour down to $2.50 or nothing. Mm-hmm. But if you didn't like the $2.50, you leave and I can hire somebody else for that.
Yeah.
And that's where there's always somebody who needs that job. Then, you know, it's really hard to.
If you think even Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath, that same dynamic is at play there. All the Oklahoma farmers are going starving to death, and these pamphlets are out there. Come to California and pick fruit, and you'll make a good living for your family.
Yeah.
And that probably could have worked for a fraction of them, but there were so many now you could work for nothing or go down the road and somebody else will take that job. So it's been a constant struggle.
It's a constant back and forth.
Yeah.
And I would say that we really should be ending the show with Woody Guthrie songs, because Woody wrote so many of them about mine strikes or the labor, you know, come along with me in 1918 to Calumet, Michigan in the Copper Country. They're having their Christmas ball, and they lock people in and torch the place. Mm. And there's just a level that we don't always get to in our studies. So we tried to put some of it in our local history books.
Yeah.
You never can do enough. So
yeah, I don't mean to dwell on larger issues outside of our community.
But it's part of it.
It illustrates the tension that occurred even here.
Well, in writing local history, Dwayne Smith was a wonderful professor of history at Fort Lewis. He's now passed away. He was so easy to work with. He'd written 50 books, and I'd written like a couple brochures. But the feeling was that you still need to give local history a national or international context,
right,
in order for it to feel real. Mm. You can't just say, and then Myrtle buried Fred, and that's chapter one. You know. So we tried to do some of that because the people who are working here still had that. And then as we get into 20th century mining, as once some of the labor issues have settled down here, more because the mines were closing than anything else, you know that all of a sudden we see they're still pulling ore out of the Capital Prize mine, but it's one guy going in or two or three guys going in and coming out and putting it in their truck and driving their truck to Denver or to Leadville.
There's still some of that in Clear Creek County now.
You know, it still works. The ore's there.
Yeah, that's right.
But can you make money out of doing it? Yeah.
Yeah. To that point, Chris, when I was in the business, the company I worked for, we discovered a silver lode on the backside of Bulldog Mountain in Creed, Colorado, that is the largest deposit in the world. And at the time, this was 40 years ago, but at the time, the price of silver was $14 an ounce, and the cost to extract it was $22
an ounce. Here's
so it sits there to this day.
I think we're running out of time.
Oh, are we? Okay.
But it's been fun, and there's more to be learned about the sun and the moon. I'm convinced of that. I need to do more Idaho Springs research.
Well, hopefully we'll have Lou back shortly,
so.
And I'm sure she'll have something to say on the subject. I guess that's going to be it for today, right? Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much,
thanks.
Christine.
Thanks. Good
very
to see you,
interesting.
Lord.
Yeah. Wasn't
yeah.
it great?
Yeah. Very,
yeah.
Very interesting.
You know, it's hard enough, believe me, going underground and working underground is hard enough without wondering if you're going to get paid have a job tomorrow.
Yeah. You're going to get blown up. You're going to a rock fall on your head. And are you going to get paid? Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of crazy. Mm-hmm. Yep. All right, everyone, thanks for joining us today. And Lori, we're gonna work, since I've been slacking and out of the picture for a few weeks. Lori and I need to catch up our schedule, but we're gonna get some good shows together. We've been talking about some of the guests that we'd like to rein in here. And Chris, when do you think we should have you back?
Well, let's compare notes afterwards. November, maybe the week before Thanksgiving.
Should we try to contact Lou, maybe?
Yep. Yep.
Okay. All right.
We'll wait a couple weeks and see what she's doing. I got a couple different ideas for
okay.
programs.
So that's some housekeeping that we should have done off air, but nevertheless, thank you so much for joining us today, Chris. You're always a joy to listen to. And thanks to all of our listeners out there in Clear Creek County. We'll be back next week with another show. Lori, take care till then.
Yeah. And our ballots have dropped.
Yeah.
Vote, everyone.
Oh, that's right.
And
let's talk about that for a moment.
Please vote.
Yeah.
Please look into and vote yes on 1A.
I couldn't agree more. I think that's going to be so important to the future of our community. We've got to support local services. So, again, thanks everyone for joining us. See you next week. Bye.